I'm Alex Rodriguez.
And I'm Jason Kelly.
From Bloomberg, this is The Deal. Each week, you'll hear us in conversation with business icons.
This show will explore deal-making across sports, media, and entertainment.
That is a harsh lesson in business.
Sports is not as simple as bringing a bunch of big names together.
I didn't want to do another stomp you out speech.
It opened up so many more doors.
The show is called The Deal.
Listen to The Deal wherever you get your podcast.
And watch on Bloomberg Originals, Bloomberg Television, or BTV Plus.
Bloomberg Audio Studios.
Podcasts, radio, news.
This is Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Messer and Tim Stenebeck on Bloomberg Radio.
Carol, do you ever think about maybe giving up that office job and all the trappings
of a
stable life in the city or the suburbs, and maybe moving to another country, doing something completely different, like starting a vineyard, starting a winery, making some rosé?
Sounds like it would be a joy.
Well, it's exactly what Stephen Kroenke did. He, his wife, Jeannie, and their three kids left South London and a career in telecommunications, at least for Stephen, during the financial crisis to move to a small village in the heart of Provence, despite not even speaking much French, to make some wine.
Sounds magical. And that's exactly what they've been doing for the last decade plus. Stephen is owner of Maison Mirabeau. It's a winery in Provence that not only produces rosé, but also practices regenerative farming, which is something we've been talking about a lot lately. Stephen joining us right here in our Bloomberg Interactive Broker studio. So delighted to have you. Thank you for coming in. That switch in career, had you been thinking about it for a long time? How hard was that?
Yes, it was a slow burn. It took a long time to persuade my wife to sell the house, to take the children out of school and move to the south of France. It actually took 10 years. And I've been talking about it for so long, and my friends were getting bored.
And I had this, do it or shut up.
Just basically. Do it or shut up. And I had this one friend came to see us from Switzerland, and he said, Stephen, you've been talking about this every time I come here. And he said, let's put some dates on the table. So in fact, we used to have a blackboard in our kitchen. And we said, okay, so when are you going to do this? And we sort of worked it back. And in the end, we ended up with a date of May 2006. And he took a photograph of that. And he went back to Switzerland. And in May 2006, he sent me that photograph and said, so where are you living now? And he knew where I was living. And I felt like that guy who was talking about it. So I went into action. I'd already kind of paid off most of the mortgage by then, because that was the only financing we had.
Yeah.
You know, you're either born into this world or you buy into it. But we didn't have a huge amount of capital. I made enough to do that. So I started doing research, and you know, there's an expression in the wine trade, which is you can make a small fortune in the wine trade if you start with a large fortune.
Yeah, I was going to say.
It's highly capital intensive, and it was always going to be a struggle. And I was trying to work out, okay, so if I buy a vineyard, how do I scale? And then I met a guy in the south of France when I was doing my research, and he said, Stephen, there are three V's in the wine business. Viticulture, so growing the grapes. Vinification, turning grapes into wine. And vendre, selling the stuff. Mm. And he said, there are many people here who are great at growing grapes and making wine, but the hard bit's actually selling the stuff.
Yeah.
So why don't you focus on that? So we sort of approach it from the other way around. It's a bit like the champagne model. So oftentimes the champagne brands won't own all the land. They'll work with growers. So this was great because it suddenly opened up a new way of doing things, and particularly in Provence, where the cost of land is expensive. And this is where the megastars come to live. I mean, it's one of the most beautiful parts of the world. It is absolutely beautiful. And so this way we could actually find the growers to work with and kind of reverse engineer it. So we decided to build the brand first. And I found the growers to work with. I went into Waitrose, which is one of the big stores in the UK, and convinced him that I could make this wine fly off shelves. And that's how it started.
So you basically created the brand, created the market, and then went back to kind of figuring out how you want to be really doing it.
Exactly. So we 5 years ago, we bought the vineyard, but we built the brand for the first 10 years.
Stephen, talk to us about, you said you kind of worked a little bit backwards, developed the brand, developed the market for what you guys do, and then kind of went backwards. Regenerative farming, did you know you always wanted to do that? And how easy was that to do in making wine?
No, I didn't know I was going to do it. When we bought the vineyard, I actually looked at 39 vineyards before we found the right one. I mean, it's inland from Saint-Tropez, it's surrounded by nature reserve, it's the most stunning parcel of land. But it had been farmed conventionally for 20 plus years. And when I say conventionally, I mean they spray it with everything. Yeah. And so the soil organic matter was nearly dead.
I was going to say, wasn't it worn out?
Yeah, it was worn out, completely depleted. I knew I always wanted to farm organically, but organic farming doesn't give you a pathway to rebuild. It just gives you a checklist of what you can't do.
Right.
So you can't spray any synthetic fertilizers and herbicides. But a friend of mine sent me an article written by Eric Asimov of the New York Times.
A wine guy, we could say.
A very good wine guy.
Son of a science fiction guy, but a wine guy.
Yeah, exactly. And he'd written an article about this lady in Oregon called Mimi Castillo. And she was farming regeneratively, and I'd seen in the article pictures of goats and chickens and sheep running around the vineyard, completely overgrown. And I thought, I want some of that. And the article talked about the fact that soil can rebuild, and so, yeah, I reached out to her.
Does it make a big difference for the grapes, the taste, and then, of course, the wine?
It does. But actually, when I realized that wine schools weren't teaching this, I formed a non-profit 3 years ago and brought Mimi in as a trustee and a permaculturist. And now we have 8 different trustees supporting it. And we want to prove the science that actually it does work and it tastes better. And actually, you know, it seems to be that input costs drop as well, because you're not plowing or spraying. You're working with nature rather than against it. You're working in a polyculture rather than a monoculture.
Right.
So if input costs can drop, yields can be stable, but quality can increase. It's like, what's not to like? So we're on a mission to sort of convert the world to farming regeneratively, to lose the mindset of monoculture.
We brought some wines and I want to try a little bit and you can walk us through it. But this whole idea of using animals, right, to kind of like rework the soil and, you know, they're eating, they're doing their duty, if you will, but it's all working into the soil. It's kind of wild, right? But so natural.
Yeah.
Am I being too base?
No.
Is that the definition of regenerative farming?
Yeah. I was trying to figure out.
Yeah, but that's exactly what it is.
Right?
It is wild,
so
and it's
cool.
Natural.
That's why the animals are running around, right?
Yeah, exactly. That's exactly it. You're trying to basically duplicate what happens in nature in the vineyard in a way that still works for the vines.
I love it.
So it makes perfect sense.
All right. Tell us, we've got 3 wines here, and tell us.
So the first one is, we call Mirabeau Pure, which is our flagship wine. So this one, if we're getting a fancy account, we'll always try and get it in there. So I would say it's a classic Provence rosé.
Yeah.
One of the great things about Provence rosé is it's always dry. Mm-hmm. And that's one reason why people always go to Provence for their rosé wines. And it's also the only wine region in the world that focuses itself on rosé. So it's 91% of production is now rosé wine. So this is super refreshing.
90% of the world's production?
No, 91% of the production from Provence is rosé.
Okay.
So it's only a few percent of red and white. So there's no other wine region in the world like that. So we really are the experts in Provence. And these wines are so versatile. So you could imagine sipping this by the pool without any food, but also it goes so well with so many
different food types. It's not just because it's Friday and it's been a week, but this is lovely.
Thank you.
Very good.
No, it's gorgeous.
How much does a bottle of this retail for?
This is about $25.
Okay. It's great.
Well, you know, that's interesting because we spend so much time talking about price point. I mean, that's a great price point. And it's interesting. I feel like there's been this new reality in wine that you don't necessarily have to spend a ton of money.
Yeah, no, I think wine at lower price points is getting much better quality than it was.
Is that a way of also getting to the younger generation that we continually talk about that say that they're not interested in wine anymore?
Or even not interested in alcohol.
Or alcohol.
That's an issue these days.
I know. My kids aren't like that.
What's wrong with them? I'm just kidding.
I think it's funny. I was listening to an article recently about cocktails, and because cocktails are really on trend. I think during the pandemic, people got used to that. And the cocktail's made in front of you in a bar, and you feel really special wine by the glass is often the same price as a cocktail.
Yeah.
And it's poured out of the bottle because all the work's happened at the other end
of
the supply chain.
All right, so talk to us about the second wine.
The second wine, okay, now if you put your nose into that, it smells a little bit different. And that's because it's actually been oak aged.
Oh, yeah.
So this is...
It is different.
It is different. It's a very different style as well.
I'm not a big rosé person, but it's nice. I love it. I love that.
Exactly. Well, actually, if you close your eyes, you probably think this is a fancy white Burgundy. It's really, really stylish. This is from our estate, so this is regenerative farmed and it's organic, but it's had 6 months in oak barrels. So it gives a very...
That's good. That's a really good one.
I always love the talk about the barrels. We've gotten kind of an education over the years about the importance of them and the difference, and it does make... It's a factor in all of this.
And what's this one called?
This is called La Réserve by Domaine Mirabeau.
Tim's taking notes.
Yes. So it's because we called it La Réserve because it's in a nature reserve, and we're really... This is our regen wine. And we're certifying regen, and this is something that's very interesting. So if you want to put organic on the label, you have to be certified organic.
Right, I understand.
But now regenerative is becoming more and more popular, so people want to certify regenerative.
This is what we talked about with the folks at Common Ground, where we talk about this movie kind of off air, this documentary, but this idea of like, I'm like, well, so how do I know when I'm buying something? And they're saying that there's increasingly, there's a marks, there's a demarcation, if you will, or notification on if you buy some kind of produce or something that's bought that way. And so you guys are doing the same thing.
Yeah, we're doing that, and I think more and more growers will do, because the supermarkets want to know if it's properly farmed regeneratively, if they're going to talk about it. But actually, that's really, I think the supermarkets are going to get behind regen now. You're going to see in the UK, you know, some of the big supermarkets are really starting to talk about
it. I'm going
to
say, it feels a little bit like super dating. Not that I've ever done this, or speed dating, but it's speed, it's speed drinking a little bit, but you're so kind walking us through it. So Stephen, we have one more because we want to get to this last one.
This is not a wine.
Before you take
this
a big sip of it.
No, I smelled it.
So this is Mirabeau Riviera Gin.
Don't chug it, Carol.
Yeah. I'm not a chugger anyway.
Carol.
Don't you know me?
Yeah, I do.
So this is a gin.
It's a gin made from upcycled grape skins.
But is that what gin is usually made of?
Gin is usually made from wheat or corn. It's a grain based.
That is interesting.
And this is super smooth. So being made of grapes, it gives it a roundness on the palate.
Right.
That's 43% alcohol by volume. Yet it's so smooth. We keep a bottle in the freezer just to chuck into a martini when we fancy it.
I need to keep just a bottle in the freezer. No, it's
Do you have
interesting.
A freezer under so, your desk that we could use?
So, do you plan to expand out the line more?
Well,
this seems like a lot.
Yeah, no, it's a lot. I keep saying no more NPD. But then
what's NPD?
New product development.
Oh, okay.
Sorry.
Okay.
But then the market's changed. The young people who have going no and low alc is the big growth category.
This one is normally no alcohol.
Yeah, I mean, I'll take a sip of wine or two,
but
it's like as I've gotten older. I mean, I think a lot of my friends have done this. We just drink a lot less.
Yeah. And that's
a challenge, I think, for the industry.
It is. The young aren't drinking as much. The older people are taking more care of their health. The WHO came out last year and said there's no safe amount of alcohol. It's like, oh my gosh, guys, come on.
They're just wrong.
Yeah.
You know what they need? They need a drink.
They need a drink. No, but it's interesting. Are you limited, though? We've only got about 30 seconds left. Are you limited by your land size of how much variety you can do or no?
No, because we're working with so many growers from around the region. So our wine estate represents a small part of what we do. So we can scale this business.
All right, Stephen, I'm just going to say it. You're kind of one of our favorite kind of guests. So you can come back anytime. No, but this has been really fun. And if we find our way in Provence, I'm going to come knock on your door.
You must do that.
Okay, just like more than
Let's
wife.
Let's do a remote. We'll do a remote from there.
That would be great. Really lovely. Stephen, thank you.
Thank you
so
very
appreciate
much.
It. Stephen Cronk, founder and CEO of Maison Mirabeau, joining us here in studio. This is Bloomberg.
From Silicon Valley to Wall Street, the promise and perils of artificial intelligence are playing out on the world stage. But what will the next phase of AI adoption look like? Which companies, from big tech to startups, will dominate? And where do the risks and unintended consequences lie? I'm Emily Chang. Join me at Bloomberg Tech in San Francisco, May 9th, to answer many of the industry's burning questions, alongside Snap's Evan Spiegel, Xbox President Sarah Bond, OpenAI's Brad Lightcap, top researcher Dr. Fei-Fei Li of Stanford, and many more. More details and just a few tickets left at Bloomberg.com/TechSF.